A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He wants to explore social experimentation. This thing where you deliberately tweak your behavior just a little. Not to mess with anyone, but to watch how they respond. You know, politely dodging a routine personal question at a party. Not because you have something to hide, but because you're genuinely curious how hard people will push for reciprocal disclosure. He's asking four things. Is there an academic name for this? And how does it connect to Garfinkel's breaching experiments, impression management, strategic ambiguity, all that? Who are the best known practitioners, from academics to comedians to filmmakers, and what separates science from entertainment from just being a jerk? What have we actually learned about human nature from watching people squirm when the script breaks? And where's the ethical line? When does this stop being curiosity and start being manipulation?
That last question is the one that makes this whole thing worth discussing, honestly. Because the impulse itself is fascinating, this quiet, observational mischief, but it sits on a knife's edge between insight and harm. And the academic name Daniel's fishing for, the foundational framework, is Harold Garfinkel's breaching experiments. Garfinkel was a sociologist at UCLA in the 1960s, and he basically invented this as a method. He'd send his students home for the weekend with instructions to act like boarders in their own family homes. Polite, formal, asking permission to use the bathroom, addressing their parents as Mr. and Mrs.
They became strangers in their own kitchens.
And the reactions were volcanic. Parents reported shock, anger, accusations of mental illness. Siblings got distressed. Garfinkel documented families demanding to know what was wrong, what had happened, whether the student was on drugs or having a breakdown. The experiment wasn't about being rude. It was about removing the taken-for-granted background expectations that make family life legible. And when those expectations vanished, people didn't just feel awkward. They felt threatened.
Which is already telling us something, right? If a polite boarder in your own son's body makes you angry enough to suggest psychiatric intervention, we're not dealing with etiquette. This is deeper than manners.
That's exactly Garfinkel's point. He argued that social order isn't something we just follow. It's something we constantly produce, moment by moment, through countless tiny cooperative acts. When someone stops cooperating, the whole fragile machinery becomes visible. And that visibility is disturbing. People don't just notice the breach, they mobilize to repair it. They demand explanations. They get hostile. They try to laugh it off or reframe it as a joke. Anything to restore the shared reality.
The discomfort isn't a side effect. It's the whole point of the method.
And that brings us to the second name Daniel mentioned, Irving Goffman. 1956, The Presentation of Self in Everyday Life. Goffman gave us the dramaturgical framework, this idea that we're all performers maintaining a face, managing impressions, working together to sustain a definition of the situation. A breaching experiment rips the mask off. It exposes the backstage machinery, and that exposure is what people find so destabilizing. You're not just being weird at a party, you're refusing to co-author the scene.
Garfinkel gives us the method. Deliberately break the script and observe. Goffman gives us the theory of why breaking the script hurts. And then there's a third piece. Daniel asked about strategic ambiguity. That's a different flavor of the same impulse, isn't it?
It is, and it's worth pulling apart. Strategic ambiguity was formalized by Eric Eisenberg in a 1984 paper called Ambiguity: A Strategy in Organizational Communication. The idea is that deliberate vagueness can be a tool. You leave things open to multiple interpretations so you can preserve relationships, test boundaries, or avoid committing to a position you might need to abandon. It's not a breach exactly, it's more like leaving the script blurry on purpose.
Which is the corporate version of what Daniel's describing at that party. You don't refuse to answer the question. You just answer it in a way that doesn't quite land.
Watch what the other person does with the ambiguity. Do they fill in the gaps? Do they press harder? Do they get visibly uncomfortable and change the subject? Eisenberg was writing about organizations, but the mechanism is the same. ambiguity forces the other person to do interpretive work, and how they do that work reveals their assumptions, their anxieties, their priorities.
We've got three layers now. Garfinkel is the sledgehammer, full script violation. Observe the repair attempts. Goffman is the lens. Here's why the script matters. Here's what's at stake when it breaks. Eisenberg is the scalpel. Introduce just enough fog to see what the other person projects onto it.
The psychological mechanism underneath all three is what researchers call the repair imperative. When a conversational norm is violated, say someone gives a wildly unexpected answer to "how are you," the listener's brain doesn't just register surprise. It treats the violation as a problem to be solved. Studies show people will interrupt, laugh nervously, repeat the question, or offer face-saving reinterpretations, all within seconds. They work hard to restore coherence.
I've seen this in action. Someone asks, "How's it going?" And instead of "Fine, you?" the person says, "Honestly, I've been thinking a lot about mortality." And the asker almost physically recoils, then laughs, then says something like, "Well, that's Tuesday for you," and pivots. The repair happens in under 3 seconds.
That speed tells you something important. These scripts aren't just social lubricant. They're trust maintenance mechanisms. When I ask how you are, and you say, "Fine," we're not exchanging information. We're performing a tiny ritual of mutual recognition. You're signaling that you're still playing the game, still cooperating, still part of the shared reality. When you break the ritual, I don't just think you're weird. I experience a micro-threat to the cooperative framework that lets me navigate the world.
Which is why Garfinkel's parents were angry, not just confused. The threat wasn't to their comfort. It was to their sense that they knew who their child was and what their home meant.
And this is where the research gets profound. What breaching experiments reveal is that social reality is a collective achievement. It's not just out there, waiting to be perceived. We build it together, constantly, through these tiny acts of coordination. When someone stops building, the whole thing wobbles. And most people would rather accept a coherent but false narrative than live with that wobble.
That's a terrifying sentence, and I want to sit with it. But first, let's pull on the other thread Daniel mentioned. The practitioners. Garfinkel is the academic origin, but he's not the only person who ever thought to poke at the social fabric and watch it tear.
And this is where we move from the lab to the stage. Nathan Fielder is maybe the purest contemporary example. His HBO show, The Rehearsal, which premiered in 2022, is basically a breaching experiment with a budget. Fielder builds elaborate simulations of real-life social situations, rehearses them with actors, and then steps into the actual interaction, having essentially gamed out every possible branch.
He's Garfinkel with a set designer.
With a fundamentally different relationship to his subjects. Garfinkel students knew they were in an experiment, even if their families didn't. Fielder's subjects often know they're participating in something, but they don't know the full extent of the manipulation. In one episode, he rehearses a difficult conversation with a friend about a parenting disagreement. The rehearsal becomes this recursive nightmare. He's rehearsing the rehearsal, then rehearsing the reaction to the rehearsal. It stops being about the conversation and becomes about the impossibility of truly preparing for human interaction.
Which is the meta layer that makes Fielder different from, say, Sacha Baron Cohen. Cohen's whole thing, Borat, Bruno, the various characters, is that the target has no idea they're in a constructed scenario. The Kazakh journalist is interviewing real Americans who think they're being polite to a foreign visitor, and their real prejudices come spilling out.
The 2006 Borat film is the canonical example. Hidden cameras, unwitting participants, a character designed to be just absurd enough that people drop their guard. The humor comes from watching real people navigate an impossible norm violation. They're trying to be polite to someone whose behavior makes no sense within their framework, and in that scramble, they reveal things about themselves they'd never say to a camera crew.
The ethical difference between Cohen and Fielder is partly about target awareness, but also about what's being exposed. Cohen is exposing bigotry and hypocrisy. The targets are often people in positions of power or privilege. Fielder is exposing something more intimate. The fragility of our own self-narratives. His subjects aren't villains. They're just people trying to navigate difficult conversations, and the show reveals how impossible that really is.
Which makes Fielder's work more ethically complicated, not less. Cohen's targets, you could argue, deserve the exposure. Fielder's subjects are just. and the show's power comes from watching them realize, in real time, that they don't fully control their own social performances.
Then there's Andy Kaufman, who makes both of them look like ethicists. The 1982 wrestling match with Jerry Lawler, Kaufman, the comedian, decides to wrestle women as part of his act, declares himself the intergender wrestling champion, and then gets into a feud with Lawler that culminates in a match where Lawler pile drives him and Kaufman is hospitalized with a neck injury.
Which may or may not have been staged. And that's the whole point. Kaufman blurred performance and reality so thoroughly that nobody, not the audience, not the producers, possibly not even Lawler, knew what was real. He took the breaching experiment to its logical extreme, not just violating a norm, but making it impossible to tell whether a norm was being violated at all.
He made the ambiguity itself the art, which is either brilliant or sociopathic, depending on how charitable you're feeling.
And that tension is what makes the whole tradition worth studying. You've got this spectrum. Garfinkel at one end, doing controlled academic work with debriefing and consent frameworks, however primitive by modern standards. Then you've got Fielder in the middle, making entertainment that doubles as a psychological investigation, with varying degrees of subject awareness. Then Cohen, using deception to expose social ills. Then Kaufman, who may not have known himself what was real.
The ethical question Daniel's asking, when does this become manipulation? Depends partly on where you sit on that spectrum, but also on three specific principles: consent, debrief, and proportionality.
Those are exactly the right categories, and they come directly out of the ethical reckoning that followed the most famous deception study in psychology, Stanley Milgram's obedience experiments at Yale, starting in 1961.
This is the one where people thought they were administering electric shocks.
40 male participants told they were part of a learning study. A confederate is strapped into a chair, electrodes attached. The participant is instructed to administer increasingly powerful shocks every time the learner makes a mistake. The shocks aren't real, but the participant doesn't know that. The learner screams, begs to be released, eventually goes silent. And 65% of participants administered the maximum 450-volt shock, a level labeled danger, severe shock, simply because an authority figure in a lab coat told them to continue.
That number is still staggering, even knowing it's coming.
And the ethical fallout was enormous. Participants were visibly distressed, sweating, trembling, some laughing uncontrollably. They'd been deceived about the nature of the study, exposed to extreme psychological pressure, and in many cases left wondering what they were capable of. The backlash led, eventually, to the Belmont Report in 1979 and the modern institutional review board system. Consent, debrief, proportionality. Those principles exist because Milgram showed what happens when they're absent.
If we use those principles as the ethical framework, where do the entertainers land?
Cohen is the hardest case. His subjects can't consent because the whole method depends on them not knowing. The debrief happens after the fact, if at all, and the distress can be significant. People lose jobs, face public humiliation. The counterargument is that the exposure serves a public good, that the targets are often powerful people whose prejudices deserve to be exposed. But that's a consequentialist defense, not a principled one. You're deciding that the insight justifies the harm. Fielder is murkier. His subjects typically consent to participate in something, but they don't know what they're consenting to. The debrief is, well, the show is the debrief, in a sense. They see the finished product and understand what happened. But the distress is real, and it's not always clear that the insight gained is proportional to the discomfort caused. Some episodes are tender and revealing. Others feel like watching someone have a minor breakdown for our entertainment.
Which brings us to the question Daniel's really asking underneath all of this. What have we actually learned? All this discomfort, all these ethical headaches, what's the payoff?
Three things, I think. First, people prefer a coherent but false narrative over an ambiguous truth. This shows up everywhere. In the repair imperative, in the way Garfinkel's families invented explanations for the border behavior rather than sitting with the uncertainty, in the way Cohen's subjects fill awkward silences with their own prejudices. We are narrative-making machines, and we'll generate a story before we'll tolerate a gap. The repair imperative is so strong that people will often gaslight themselves to preserve social order. They'll decide the violation was a joke they didn't get. They'll assume they misheard. They'll reinterpret the breach as evidence of their own social failure rather than the other person's weirdness. The instinct to maintain the shared reality overrides the instinct to accurately perceive what's happening. Trust is a cooperative achievement, not a static state. It's not something you have or don't have, it's something you do, moment by moment, with other people. And breaching experiments show how quickly it can unravel. One person stops doing the work, and within seconds the whole interaction destabilizes. That's both terrifying and kind of beautiful. It means trust is fragile, but it also means trust is constantly being rebuilt. Every mundane conversation is a small act of faith.
That's the thing that strikes me about all of this. We walk around thinking social reality is just the water we swim in. But it's actually a construction project that never stops, and we're all on the crew.
Most of the time, we don't notice we're building anything. That's the mark of a well-functioning social order. It's invisible to its participants. Garfinkel's genius was realizing that you could make it visible by breaking it.
Let's get practical. Daniel's asking about this because he's curious, and presumably some of our listeners are too. What can you actually do with this knowledge without becoming an ethical nightmare?
First, recognize the repair imperative in your own conversations. When someone violates a norm, gives a weird answer, breaks a script, introduces unexpected honesty, notice your instinct to smooth it over. Ask yourself, am I repairing for connection or am I just avoiding discomfort? Sometimes the repair is kind. Sometimes it's a way of shutting down something interesting.
The first move is just noticing the reflex.
Second, you can use small, intentional norm violations as a diagnostic tool. If you're in a group where honesty is supposedly valued but never actually practiced, try answering, "How are you?" honestly. Not with a trauma dump, just with something real. Watch what happens. Does the group make space for it? Does someone change the subject? The reaction tells you something about the group's actual tolerance for authenticity.
That's a useful social litmus test. Low stakes, easy to do, and the information you get is real.
Third, for anyone who wants to push further, creators, curious people, the Nathan Fielder aspirants out there, the ethical line is clear. If the subject can't consent, the experiment has to be low stakes and the debrief has to happen. If the distress outweighs the insight, it's not worth it. And if you're not willing to be on the receiving end of your own experiment, you shouldn't be running it.
The Kaufman problem. He may or may not have been willing to take the pile driver, but the audience sure didn't get a debrief.
And that's the difference between art that illuminates and art that just destabilizes for its own sake. The best social experimentation, whether it's Garfinkel in a lab or Fielder on a soundstage, leaves you understanding something you didn't understand before. It doesn't just break the script. It shows you what the script was doing in the first place.
Which is the mirror function. Social experimentation isn't really about the experimenter. It's about what the reaction reveals about all of us. The invisible architecture of shared life, suddenly made visible.
That architecture is something we're all co-authoring every day, whether we notice or not. The person who answers, "How are you?" honestly at a party isn't just being weird. They're reminding everyone in earshot that the script is optional. That's unsettling, but it's also freeing.
You've got the tools. But there's one more question that keeps me up at night, and it's only getting more urgent. As AI agents and chatbots increasingly participate in social spaces, answering customer service calls, posting in forums, sliding into comment sections, who gets to set the norms? And what happens when the breacher isn't a human being, but an algorithm that doesn't even know it's violating anything?
That's the frontier. We've spent decades studying what happens when humans break social scripts. We have almost no idea what happens when the breaker has no social understanding at all, just statistical patterns and an objective function. An AI doesn't experience the repair imperative. It doesn't feel the wobble when shared reality destabilizes. It just keeps generating text.
We're already seeing this in the wild. Deepfakes, synthetic media, bots that mimic human social patterns without understanding any of them. We're about to face norm violations we can't easily detect, from agents that can't be debriefed and can't meaningfully consent to anything.
Which means understanding our own repair imperative might become a survival skill. If you can't tell whether the person breaking the script is a curious human, a comedian, or a language model fine-tuned for engagement, your instinct to repair might be the thing that gets exploited.
The practical advice scales up. Notice the reflex. Ask what it's serving. And next time you're at a party and someone gives a weird answer, pause before you repair.
You might learn something.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the late Victorian period, a British expedition to Bhutan documented a single fungal mycelial network spanning nearly 3 square miles beneath a monastery courtyard, preserved in expedition records as the largest living organism any member of the party had ever seen. Though they had no concept of what a mycelial network actually was, and described it as subterranean phosphorescent cobweb of unknown origin.
Subterranean phosphorescent cobweb.
That's going to be the name of my next DJ set.
Please don't. What?
Already mentally designing the poster.
This has been my weird prompts. Thanks to our producer Hilbert Flumingtop for the fact and for keeping this whole operation running. If you enjoyed this episode, do us a favor and leave a review wherever you listen. It helps people find the show. We'll be back soon with whatever Daniel sends us next.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, my weird prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.